And welcome to Reader's Digress, the podcast where we read nonfiction books so that you don't have to, unless you want to. My name is Kate.
And I forgot that I was going to talk. And my name is Molly. And today Kate is telling me about Prince Harry's book. What is the name of it?
Molly. This book is called Spare.
That's it.
I have to tell you why at this point, because he describes that his family would refer to his older brother, Prince William, as the heir and him as the spare.
Oh my God.
Allegedly. I have to say allegedly. I don't know how much of that is actually true.
The face I just made was like, Kate told me the best gossip I'd ever heard. I feel like if that's true, what a like breeding ground for victimhood.
Oh, and like sibling rivalry and like just general shittiness towards one another.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. We've got a lot going on in this book. I thought about making this a two-part episode, and then I was like, do we really want to talk about this?
Nobody can listen.
I'm like, does anyone want to listen to 2 hours of this?
Oh my God. So, well, I, for one, am riveted.
Already. So we will try to get through as much as possible. There are some fun things that I want to talk about. There are some irritating things that I want to talk about. Ooh. And then there are some things that I think are kind of missed opportunities. So I will start with a very, very brief summary and give you an idea of what this book is about. So Spare is Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex. I'm not going to call him that just for the record, but that is his title.
Call him that old time. The Duke of Sussex.
Sussex.
Oh my God.
Okay, actually that was a Freudian slip and it worked really well. The Duke of Sussex.
Well, I was about to say like that he was referring to his todger, so it really truly was.
I'm already nauseous.
Dry heaving.
So Spare is his tele-memoir, which was published at the beginning of this year in January 2023. It was ghostwritten by J.R. Moeringer. I'm sorry if I'm saying that name incorrectly. And for some truly inexplicable and wholly unnecessary reason, it is 415 pages long.
No! Yes.
I wish the listeners could see me shaking my head. This is my biggest regret, is that I read this entire book.
cover to cover, in fact.
Anyway, Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan Markle, a former actress born and raised in Los Angeles, stepped down from their royal duties in early 2020. So a big part of the book is kind of covering that and the aftermath. But the way that I want to tell you about this book is through three themes. I'm doing alliteration.
Okay.
So structure of the book. I'm going to talk about struggles. So things that I feel like actually humanized Prince Harry and the royal family. And then the final section is just size. Because that is me being like...
Yes, okay.
In between, there's some funny excerpts that I just could not talk about. So keeping with the alliteration, those are snort breaks. So
snort breaks, yes. Okay. I can't wait.
Okay. So this book is broken into three parts of Prince Harry's life. The beginning is his childhood after his mom died at age 12 until the age of about 21 when he joined the military.
Okay.
Section two is his life and career in the military and just a little bit on his post-military role as a full-time royal, whatever that even is.
Gross.
And then section three details his life after he met and fell in love with Meghan Markle.
Okay.
And the falling out from leaving his royal family.
His full-time royalness.
So, okay, Molly.
Let's get into it.
Let's get into it. I have to read you this section from the very first chapter of the book.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
just to give you an idea of how this book is written.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first chapter, he recounts a story after his grandfather's funeral.
Okay.
Where he, his father Charles, and Prince William get into an argument about Prince Harry's leaving the royal family.
Okay.
And they're like in this, you know, room, just the three of them. They're arguing and they are yelling at each other. And this is the conversation. So this is him writing. He said, do they not know why I left the royal family? And he looks up at the trees. You don't know. Harold, I honestly don't, said Willie. He calls his brother Willie, which...
Ew, so sorry, why is there so much dick stuff in this?
Regrettably, I don't know. I turned to Pa. He was gazing at me with an expression that said, neither do I. Wow, I thought, maybe they really don't. Staggering. But maybe it was true. And if they didn't know why I'd left, maybe they just didn't know me at all. And maybe they never really did. And to be fair, maybe I didn't either. The thought made me feel colder and terribly alone. But it also fired me up. I thought, I have to tell them. How can I tell them? I can't. It would take too long. Besides, they're clearly not in the right frame of mind to listen. Not now, anyway. Not today. And so, Paul, Willie, world, here you go.
No, Kate, I'm so embarrassed. Kate is holding an imaginary gun to her head.
I truly just read that and I was like, oh, so that's the kind of book this is going to be?
This is great. So bad. I want to take a moment of silence for the ghostwriter.
Okay, that's kind of like part of the issue, though, is I think the ghostwriter
was bad.
Was bad and purposely sensationalizing it.
I mean, sure.
It is a tell-all.
Yeah.
But, geez.
It's written like a soap opera, though.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow.
It's like the Lifetime movie of books.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So I just needed to establish that, like, that's the tone.
This is what we're working with
here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
And it's also so disingenuous for him to start the book out establishing that he's writing this book for his brother and dad to understand his decisions, which he's really clearly writing it to make money.
Yeah.
So
also, like,
why would you even claim that? I know that's not true.
Can you imagine how much Prince William and Kate, whom I assume hate each other, but they probably laughed their asses off reading this book. Like, this is probably the hardest they have laughed in years.
It was the hardest I've laughed in years. I can tell you that.
And I don't even know these people. Oh my God. This is amazing. I can't wait. Okay.
So there's also a moment in the first couple of chapters where he talks about how he doesn't have a very good memory after his mother has died.
Okay.
Because he starts to sort of repress some things and he is just like he says that like his grief over losing his mother has caused memory issues for a really long time. He establishes that, but then it also means that the first part of the book is really disjointed.
Hmm.
And it kind of reads like these little vignettes of him responding to prompts that the ghostwriter clearly asked him.
Interesting.
So, like, what was the worst part of your experience at boarding school? What was the best part of your experience at boarding school? And it's just so much disjointedness. Like, yeah. You're reading it and you're just like, there's no narrative here, really. It's just a series of stories that are not particularly interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the first like 100 and some pages of the book.
Wow. Really impressive that you continued on.
Is it impressive or is it just a bad decision?
Should I be applauded or taken away?
He does reveal though that he thought about going to university because he considered a course in art history because a lot of pretty girls took that subject. Ugh. Hence us. I do have to give him credit for recognizing that art history girls are pretty.
That is true. seems a little shallow of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
Go for the art and come and stay for the women, I guess. But
go for the art, stay for the beauty. That's what we always say.
Well, real recognizes real. Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. In the first chapters, again, he's like talking about how his memory is sort of like disjointed.
It's so funny to talk about having a bad memory in your memoir.
Literally, that's so exactly funny. What I was about to bring up.
Oh God.
He makes it a point to call out that his memory is inaccurate, which is so weird because when you're reading a memoir, you're aware that there are likely other versions of the stories that they chose to tell.
Right.
And so it seems to a certain extent not worth pointing out unless he's trying to hedge that his memory is less accurate than other people's, in which case I don't know that I can believe anything in this book, which is also a weird precedent to set up for your readers.
Yes. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the unreliable narrative stuff we talked about with Anthony Bourdain. But in that instance, he wasn't actively being like, yeah, clearly in the future, all of this went to shit. So what do I know? You know, like he isn't already setting up the fact that he's unreliable the book. That's weird.
So this is a quote. He writes, "Whatever the cause, my memory is my memory. It just does what it does, gathers and curates as it sees fit. And there's just as much truth in what I remember and how I remember it as there is in so-called objective facts."
Oh my God. Kate.
So I don't really know what to do with that as a reader. Like, I don't know how to use that in a positive way.
Here's what I'll say. I do think there is accuracy to the statement that whether it actually happened that way or not, if you experienced it that way, like if you thought someone was yelling at you, even if they weren't, and you experienced it that way, it affects you.
Yeah.
But, and that is legitimate. You were affected by it. But that is not the same thing as it happening.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's the distinction he's trying to make, but it's very clumsily done. And it implies that his perception of reality is the same thing as reality, which is not actually true.
Yeah. And it also gives no room for exactly what you're talking about from anyone else's perspective, because other people also have their perception of reality.
Right.
And if you're saying that your perception of reality is reality, then that means other people's perception of reality cannot be reality.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, it just gets so tricky because it's like, well, if that can't be true for you, but not true for others.
Yeah. It's like that cultural phenomenon that's happened in the last like 5 years of like my truth thing.
Yeah.
Which is like, again, I see the legitimacy in that your experience is valid and affects you, but I don't love when people refer to it as their truth because it's like that implies that someone else's is less legitimate or could not, your perception shouldn't be challenged in any way, even though it like clearly should at times.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. For sure.
Got it. So we're starting off really strong.
So I just had to like get some of that stuff out of the way to just ground you in this book and how it is. There are a couple of things that I want to say about the ghostwriting. The writing in this book, as I mentioned, is at times sensationalized, which is irritating because he spends about 80% of the book complaining about the press and how they sensationalize things.
Okay,
you certainly had a choice over who is going to be your ghostwriter. And if you didn't want it to feel sensationalized, you probably should have chosen a different writer. And that was within your decision-making power. So here's a quote that's an example, and it's talking about the heir and the spare.
Oh, God.
So he's in a castle because his family owns multiple castles.
Hard to claim victimhood when you're in a castle, but keep going.
Balmoral, which is a castle that they own, one of the many, had 50 bedrooms. And then later he says that him and William are sharing a room. Okay, whatever.
Weird. Why?
My half of the room, literally, why? My half of the room was far smaller. I didn't care why, but I also didn't need to ask why. 2 years older than me, Willie was the heir, whereas I was the spare. This wasn't just how the press referred to us. This was shorthand often used by Pa and Mummy and Grandpa.
Oh my God. He is writing like a 14-year-old.
Yes.
Willie had the bigger half of the room.
In our castle!
And I was happy with what I had, these scraps in the corner.
Like, literally, dude. And it's like, dude, you can't possibly put this in the book without understanding how this would come off, that you would be complaining about living in a castle.
Yes, also.
You're complaining about living in a castle. I don't know what else to say.
And let's just put this out there. If your castle has 50 bedrooms, imagine how many other rooms it also has to have.
Right. It's not that every room in the castle is a bedroom. It's that there are many, many, many rooms, and 50 of them are bedrooms.
And yet you still found time to complain about that. Why were they sharing a room? That's so crazy.
Literally, who knows?
Anyway, this is amazing. Keep going.
So there is, again, this very disjointed first section of the book. There's a distance, I think, between Prince Harry's voice and the author's that feels significant, and it really, like, takes you out of it, or that's how I felt. Mm-hmm. I do feel like this improves as the book goes on, but it's a really rough 100 pages to start off with. Okay, so we've now made it to our first snort break.
Love it.
In the first section of the book, he describes a scene where a bodyguard, because, you know, they always have bodyguards with them, where a bodyguard takes him aside when he's a teenager to ask him if he's been doing drugs, because there's like a rumor that he's been doing drugs. But what he thinks he's getting in trouble for is so much weirder. The bodyguard says, "Is there something you need to tell me?" And this is his response. "I suspected he was referring to my recent loss of virginity. Inglorious episode with an older woman. She liked horses, quite a lot, and treated me not unlike a young stallion. Quick ride, after which she'd smacked my rump and sent me off to graze. Among the many things about it that were wrong, it happened in a grassy field behind a busy pub."
Oh my God.
You know that he put that piece of information in this book because he wanted it to be picked up by the press and cause more, like, talk about this book. There is no world in which I believe that he put this in this book without wanting people to, like, lose their heads.
This was an important part of the story.
This is literally irrelevant. This is irrelevant. Again, the story isn't even about him losing his virginity. He just added this information.
It's about a woman engaging in bestiality.
It's literally about a furry.
Oh my God. This is crazy. It's also funny because I feel like in England, a busy pub is the equivalent of like a Wendy's in the States.
He lost it behind a 7-Eleven. With those, like, rotating hot dogs. We'll move on. So, amazing. All right. So that's just a little bit on the structure of this book. I want to move on and talk about some of the things that I felt like were actual struggles that his family, like, between him and his family, and also between his family and the press.
Okay.
That are, they, and I've kind of structured this so that they escalate. So there are a couple of passages where he's talking about the lack of humanity and how people don't really treat them like they are human beings, because they're this, like, larger than life figures. He talks about how the press did not rush to help Princess Diana after her car accident. His quote was, "Not one of them was checking on her, offering her help, not even comforting her." And this is, they're just taking photos of the car accident afterwards, which is just like a terrible, inhumane thing to be doing. He also describes that in the wake of her death, he remembers, like, feeling as if he had to console the public. So he writes, and he's 12 at this point.
Yeah.
"I remember consoling several folks who were prostrate, overcome, as if they knew Mummy, but also thinking, you didn't, though. You act as if you did, but you didn't know her at all." And I think that there must be so much trauma behind having a parent die mm-hmm. and then having to turn around and comfort the public who yeah. did not know her at all.
Yeah. And that also, like, in some ways caused her death.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, like, how deeply sad that is, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also, like, a clear lack of human connection within the family. Mm-hmm. So he talks repeatedly of his family's lack of physical and emotional intimacy. Mm-hmm. He talks about how, like, they never hugged. There was no physical contact. It's very sad when he comes back from the military, his first tour. He comes back and he gets a hug from Prince William mm-hmm. and, like, I don't know, a handshake or a pat on the back from his dad or something like that. And he writes, "It would have appeared to anyone at a distance a normal family greeting and interaction. But for us, it was a flamboyant, unprecedented demonstration of physical affection."
Wow.
Which is very sad to me.
Yeah, that is sad.
He talks about, too, that his dad just, like, clearly, it does not have a lot of emotional capacity or mm-hmm. maturity. Mm-hmm. He talks about his dad having trouble communicating, trouble listening, trouble being intimate face to face. Occasionally he'd, you know, they'd have dinner together and then he'd go upstairs and he'd find a letter that his dad had written telling him that he was proud of something he'd accomplished or, mm. you know, whatever. But he couldn't say that to him face to face. He also says that his dad has a teddy bear as, like, an emotionally secure object that went with him everywhere.
Whoa.
He wrote, "Teddy went everywhere with Pa. It was a pitiful object with broken arms and dangly threads, holes patched up here and there. Teddy expressed eloquently, better than Pa ever could, the essential loneliness of his childhood."
Oh my God, that is so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Oh.
Really, really sad.
Yeah, I know that the royals get, like, shit on a lot, and for good reason. You know, there's not, like, the British Empire did some very fucked up things, and
yeah.
some of those, the people in the royal family had some agency in that. But I also think that, like, the crippling trappings of royalty affect people on a level that we can't imagine and makes it much harder for them to be what we would consider good people.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just, like, emotionally mature, functioning human beings. Like, I yeah. think that being born into that level of fame and that lack of privacy mm-hmm. just must be such a completely different experience than most of us will ever understand
mm-hmm.
that it is hard. You almost have to, like, grade on a curve of yeah. his, like, emotional availability.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that it's necessarily fair to expect that he could have those, like, moments of development in his childhood and adolescence that most of us were able to have.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed that there was a lot of, especially from, like, liberal sides of things, there was a lot of commentary around the Queen's death that was like, fuck the Queen, why is anyone mourning her? And I just mm-hmm. felt very, like, not good about that. Because although I see that perspective that, like, imperialism and, what's the word?
Colonialism?
Thank you, yes. Colonization. Those things were done by the royal family. But I think that Queen Elizabeth, like, actually had a hand in dismantling a lot of it. And I know that she wasn't perfect. And she certainly, like, upheld racism within her clan. But I don't know. I just felt like there was, like, maybe more nuance that was needed rather than just being like, fuck the Queen. It was like, I don't know. She was, like, a human being who probably did often her best with what she had, and yeah. it just felt weird to not have any nuance around that.
Yeah I think that I as a white person feel like I can't As a white American, especially, I feel like I can't tell other people how they should have reacted to that. Mm-hmm. Because if I was from a country where, mm-hmm. obviously, we were colonized by Britain, but, like, my ancestors were yeah. part of the colonizers, so yeah. it's a bit different. But if I were in a different position, mm-hmm. I think that I would probably feel the same as a lot of people of like, yeah, I don't care about her death at all. And yeah. she was a bad person and whatever. So I don't know. It is very tricky when you have both a human being mm-hmm. and a symbol in yeah. one
yeah.
that those things are conflated and it's not easy to pull apart the threads of like, which are which, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Which it does make sense to be more like, fuck the monarchy. That I get. And you're right, like, you can't, sitting from our perspective, we can't say how someone from a different perspective should or shouldn't feel about it. But I think that it is so much more complicated than we ever want it to be.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And I think that's part of what is evident about the monarchy, is that you start to look at it and you're like, oh, this is also stupid. But mm-hmm. the deeper you dig, the more you realize it's just such a reflection of humanity and mm-hmm. our world and the impact that Britain has had on the world. Mm-hmm. And so it does get a lot more complicated. It's not easy. There is no, like, you know, everyone in here is definitely bad
kind yeah.
of mentality yeah. that's like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It also depends on how you define bad and yeah. good, you know? Yeah. And so all of it is very tricky and complex, mm-hmm. for sure. I will say just a last on the family intimacy point, mm-hmm. that his father and Camilla, who Prince Charles, now King Charles, married after mm-hmm. Diana's death, were constantly leaking stories to the press about him and William to make themselves look better. Because oh, no. Charles and Camilla are very not charismatic and they're not really that well liked.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would leak stories to make other people in the royal family look worse and make themselves look better.
No.
So they would like instruct their PR office to do this, which I think is so disgusting.
That's really bad.
Yeah. To be like a parent and not only be not protective of your children, but to be straight up exploitative of them.
Yeah. And especially like you're talking about young people who are like going to do like bad and embarrassing things from time to time, and exploiting that because you're an adult who does bad and embarrassing things is just like, yikes.
Yeah, pretty much. So this brings us to a lack of privacy and straight up lies. So we talked about this a little bit. I personally found it very humanizing to think about him growing up and his lack of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
For example, at 13 years old, somebody like gives him a buzz cut at his boarding school, and the press ran photos of his bad haircut and had all of these like, you know, headlines about it. And who among us has not had a bad haircut mm-hmm. at the age of 13? But none of us had, well, not none of us. I mean, there are other famous children who have had this treatment. But, like, we did not have that in headlines yeah. and in the newspaper. And, like, how terrible that must have felt mm-hmm. to be a 13-year-old who's also already awkward, already feeling weird, and then have them comment on your looks or, you know, yeah, just
and
things.
Misses your fucking mom. Like,
yeah.
Ugh, that's awful.
Yeah. God. So, little things like that. In the teen years, they spread rumors that he went to rehab, which he refutes in this book. Mm. He also talks about how royal biographies posited that his real dad was not Charles. King Charles, but it was Major Hewitt, and there were lies about his family interactions throughout the book. Occasionally he'd be like, you know, in this biography they reported that XYZ happened. None of that actually happened, you know. So there's a lot of kind of refuting of narratives that have already been put out by the press.
Yeah, that would be really hard, especially because you know that you can say that didn't happen as much as you want, and there are some people who will believe that it did.
Yeah. You yeah. know? Because once it's out there, you yeah. know, people remember those yes. things.
Yeah.
And it like impacts their biases and, mm-hmm. and what they remember. All of those, though, I would say are, I wouldn't say that they're harmless, mm-hmm. but they're just like sort of shitty things that he had to deal with. But there's also like a fair amount of actual danger that the press puts him in throughout mm-hmm. his life. Mm-hmm. And namely, when he was in the military, there were multiple times where the tour that he was going on and what battalion he was in was outed. And the Taliban, knowing where he was then, targeted those groups or explicitly said they would target him and try to kill him first.
That's because fucking he crazy.
Is a symbol of the monarchy.
Yeah.
He's a symbol of your country. Of course they would go after him and try to kill him. But because the press had ran where he was going and what he was helping with, like, they were not only putting him at danger, but everybody else in his group.
Yeah.
Because they're all with him, too. If they bomb the, like, the place where they're all there, mm-hmm. all of those people could die as well.
God, that's so fucked up.
Yeah. So, really, I think inexcusable coverage by the British press mm-hmm. in that regard. Because it's just, like, frankly, life or death.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just... What does that gain you, you know? Like, that isn't even, like, titillating gossip. Who gives a shit in Britain where he is? They're not going to go, like, see him.
Right.
You know? It's not, like, reporting that he's going to be at, like, the Tower Theater on Friday night and people are going to try to get a glimpse. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
God.
There's also this whole section that we all lived through, which is once he began dating Meghan, there was... just an onslaught of racism towards her that was absolutely disgusting. Mm-hmm. Just so much vitriol. Mm-hmm. There's a section here where he describes there was no real respite for Meg once she was inside her house. Like every previous night, Paps and so-called journalists knocked at her door, rang the bell constantly. Her dogs were losing their minds. They couldn't understand what was happening, why she wasn't answering the door, why the house was under assault. As they howled and paced in circles, she cowered in the corner of her kitchen on the floor.
Oh my God, that's so dark.
Yeah. And then later in that section, he describes one neighbor reported being offered a fortune to mount on the roof live streaming cameras aimed at Meg's windows. Another neighbor actually accepted the offer, hitched a camera to his roof, and pointed it straight at Meg's backyard. Again, she contacted the police, who again did nothing.
Oh my God.
And like that sort of thing is just so disgusting to me that like we're past the point of, you know, seeing these people as like larger than life. And you're now looking at them like they're animals in a zoo, you know?
Yeah. Wow. And I just feel like there's been such an unreasonable amount of fuck Meghan Markle narratives. Mm-hmm. And it for what? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. There's this deep-seated racism that I think is angry about the idea of a black woman having access to a white prince like mm-hmm. that. Like, she wasn't the one who was supposed to. Like, yeah. Oh, she wasn't the one who was supposed to have that horrible, horrible curse. Get over yourself.
Literally. Like, she wasn't the person who's supposed to have this godforsaken life.
Yeah, like
I don't know.
I think you are misunderstanding what being a part of a royal family is all about.
Yeah. One last thing here, which is I think very tragic and devastating, is that right after the birth of their son, their first son Archie, mm-hmm. She got pregnant again, and Meghan actually had a what I would term like a late term miscarriage because mm-hmm. of all of the stress of everything that was going on.
Ugh.
And they had to, you know, bury the fetus mm-hmm. and go through that terrible grieving period and loss, which I just think is so tragic. Ugh. And so deeply sad that something that doesn't matter, like the press being figuring out what you're doing and where mm-hmm. you are at all times, can cause the amount of stress to tragically impact something that does matter, like bringing a child into the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's no justice for that.
No, not at all. Okay, so that were some like humanizing sections that I just really wanted to cover because I feel like it's important to balance out how much I'm going to laugh at this next section.
Fair.
So snort break number two. All right. I want to emphasize that this book is not a funny book. It's just not. Like, he's not funny. The ghostwriter does not put a lot of jokes in here. It doesn't have like quips or funny anecdotes throughout. Which is what makes the next thing that I'm going to share so outrageous.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
So Prince William is getting married, and Prince Harry describes that in the days leading up to the wedding, he took the opportunity to hike the North Pole with the Wounded Warriors Veteran Group, which is a group of veterans disabled by combat who are hiking the North Pole.
Okay.
So he sees this as like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and so he goes. But then when he comes back for the wedding, he writes, "Upon arriving home, I'd been horrified to discover that my nether regions were frost-nipped as well, and while the ears and cheeks were already healing, the todger wasn't."
Then later he writes,
"Like, what was the universe out to prove by taking my penis at the same moment that it took my brother," meaning his brother is getting married.
What the fuck is wrong with him?
he does it like four or five times during that section of the story, is like references like his frostbitten dick, and I'm like, okay, this is so jarring compared to the seriousness with which you treat all the other stories in this book that I'm not even understanding like what is going on here.
Yuck, 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 my dick is frozen.
Like, literally.
Sir, please, this is your brother's wedding.
Okay.
I also just don't understand that kind of language that people use about a marriage being something that takes someone away from you. Like,
yeah.
Yes, you're right, they're going to prison for life. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, like, he talks about, like, after his dad got married, he saw less of him, and, like, he expected it to be the same for his brother. Mm-hmm. But it's like, yeah, but, like, that's a choice.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have to do that. You guys could have seen each other more and been more a part of each other's lives, but you chose not to.
Right, right. And given how hard it was for you to extract yourselves from the family, it seems like you probably were seeing enough of each other. I don't know. It just seems like it's not like you could get away from them easily. So weird.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. So
hilarious.
Now we're to our final section, which is just sighs. I want to talk first about something that I think was like good and I would have actually liked more of it.
Okay.
Which I view as like a missed opportunity.
Okay.
So he talks a little bit about, there are two sections in this that I'll bring up, but the first is that he talks about going to therapy. And he talked about how he got into a fight with Megan. He spoke to her disrespectfully. He doesn't really go into exactly like what he says or how he says it. And she told him, like, "I won't be stood for talking to that way. Like, you're going to respect me. I'm not going to bring children into a world with or a family with a man who doesn't respect women, whatever. So you need to go to therapy and like work your shit out.
Nice.
And it's like, okay, that's very reasonable, I think, as a partner to say. So he talks about how he goes to therapy, and at first it was just so difficult for him to access any of his memories about his mom as he's sort of working through the grief because he's repressed so much of it.
Yeah.
And he even talks about how at one point when he was getting out at the funeral, he remembers asking someone else how they were holding up as a 12-year-old at his mother's funeral.
Oh.
He talks at length about how he, like, didn't really believe that she was dead. He thought that maybe she had, like, run away or disappeared in some way. And so there's this part where he's in therapy. And here is the section that I'd like to read from that. "All my life, I'd told people I couldn't remember the past, couldn't remember my mom, but I never gave anyone the full picture. My memory was dead. Now, through months of therapy, my memory twitched, kicked, and sputtered. It came to life. Some days, I'd open my eyes to find Mommy standing before me. 1,000 images returned, some so bright and vivid that they were like holograms. I remembered mornings in Mommy's apartment at Kensington Palace, the nanny waking Willie and me, helping us down to Mommy's bedroom. I remember that she had a waterbed, and Willie and I would jump up and down on the mattress, screaming, laughing, our hair standing straight up. I remembered the breakfast together, Mommy loving grapefruit and lynchies. I don't know what that is. Seldom drinking coffee or tea. I remember that after breakfast, we'd embark on the working day with her, sitting by her side during the first phone calls, auditing her business meetings. I remembered Willie and me joining her for a chat with Christy Turlington, Claudia Schiffner, and Cindy Crawford. Very confusing, especially for two shy boys, or at or about the age of puberty. She talks about remembering bedtimes with her, and the therapist actually instructed him to bring in a vial of her perfume that she would always wear to sort of like spark the memories. So a little bit further down in this section, he says, I remembered one day at Ludgrove, Mommy stuffing sweets into my sock. Outside sweets were forbidden, so Mommy was flouting school rules, giggling as she did so, which made me love her even more. And so he kind of goes through like all of these very tender and very real moments with his mother that you don't, this is like page 216 of the book. This is the first time where he really talks about any like meaningful moments with anyone other than Megan. And that like connection and the love that is between them. And I kind of would have liked to have hear him talk about more of those moments with other people. He just doesn't really go into it all that much, whether it's with like friends or, you know, others. It just seemed like it was lacking for most of the book. And I so enjoyed this section. I just wish there were more of it.
Yeah. Well, especially having it be about Diana, which is just such a, the things that we know about her are so warped by the phenomenon that she was. To hear this like very intimate secret memory that is like preserved in someone's mind who actually knew her feels like a real glimpse into that life and who she was. That is interesting.
Yeah. And it, again, is very like humanizing of her, right? Of, like, she was a real person and, you know, she broke the rules, but, but, you know, it was something that was very endearing when it came to thinking about like her relationship with her son. And yeah, I don't know. I just really enjoyed sections of the book where he actually does that. There's another section of the book that I would love to just hear what you think about, because it's about his time in the military.
Okay.
And he flat out comes out and says how many people he has killed when he was in the army. But I want to, and that was what like made the headlines, is like Prince Harry tells people how many people he killed. But the way that he contextualizes this, I want to read it to you because I feel like it sort of changed my opinion of the headlines. And I want to hear what you think of this. So, most soldiers can't tell you precisely how much death is on their ledger. In battle conditions, there's often a great deal of indiscriminate firing. But in the age of Apaches and laptops, I should pause here to say that he was a helicopter pilot. So he was like specifically targeting people. Everything I did in the course of two combat tours was recorded, time-stamped. I could always say precisely how many enemy combatants I'd killed, and I felt it vital never to shy away from that number. Among the many things I learned in the Army, accountability was near the top of the list. So, my number, 25. It wasn't a number that gave me any satisfaction, but neither was it a number that made me feel ashamed. Naturally, I'd have preferred not to have that number on my military CV, on my mind, but by the same token, I'd have preferred to live in a world where there was no Taliban, a world without war. Even for an occasional practitioner of magical thinking like me, however, some realities just can't be changed. While in the heat and fog of combat, I didn't think of those 25 as people. You can't kill people if you think of them as people. You can't really harm people if you think of them as people. They were chess pieces removed from the board, bads taken away before they could kill goods. I've been trained to otherize them, trained well. On some level, I recognize this learned detachment as problematic, but I also saw it as an unavoidable part of soldiering, another reality that can't be changed.
I think it's very interesting how he describes that and doesn't necessarily draw the parallel between how people treated his family, but you can, because they, like the press and many people in the world, do not think of the royal family as people. And if they did, they wouldn't be able to treat them the way they have. And, you know, you can make the argument that the royal family has committed atrocities, so we can treat them however we want, blah, blah, blah. Yes, sure. Knock yourself out. But the point remains that there's like a very strong parallel to draw between the way he created these mental barriers and the way other people did around the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
Like writing a story about a 13-year-old whose mom just died getting a bad haircut. Like, truly go fuck yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because when I had first heard that, my response was like, gross. That feels very callous to reveal how many people you've killed as if it's something to be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
But I do appreciate that he's not shying away from the accountability of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with this section. I don't agree that, like, if you think war shouldn't happen, but then you go into the military, it's like, well, there's obviously a disconnect between that belief and your actions. And he is not in the position where he had to go into the military like so many others.
Right.
So I don't agree with him, but this is kind of like a moment of self-reflection where it's clear he has thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that he came to the conclusion that I would, or that I would want him to, mm-hmm. but at least he did have some reflection on what this means.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I imagine that that's like a difficult thing to grapple with. If you have killed people, you would have to kind of come up with some way of being okay with that, I think, especially mm-hmm. if it was in a situation like that where you're not going to be punished for those deaths, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah. You have to like kind of come to terms with it somehow. And I do think it's in some way strange to share details about that, even mm-hmm. if it is like somehow a military record. But I think maybe what he's doing is trying to prove that he's not ashamed of what he did, because it was done for, like, in his mind, a noble purpose. I have trouble with that just because people in the Taliban may be doing bad things, but they were radicalized to do those things, and it's like a machine that has destroyed them just as they are destroying others. So while I understand that maybe our only course of action that we have available is to like stop them before they cause more destruction, it still just doesn't seem as simple to me as being like, they were bad guys, so we killed them. Like,
yeah, okay, yeah,
sure.
For sure. And like, to your point, he is talking here about how he dehumanized them.
Yes.
And doesn't make the connection that they dehumanized others as they were being radicalized, right? And that
right.
Like, the same forces that were acting on him in terms of being a part of this organization mm-hmm. and dehumanizing others to do your job are the same forces that are acting on the Taliban in a lot of ways, but
yeah.
obviously to a different extent and in different ways.
Yeah, and like, it doesn't address the history of colonialization, which dehumanized brown people in order to take all of their wealth and resources.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, now I have to dehumanize these brown people because they're bad. And it's like, well, that was the same story you've been telling for hundreds of years, and it's a little weird and complicated for you to lean upon that as if, you know, there isn't this other history involved.
Yeah. And I mean, I think like it's pretty clear he views his work in the military as noble and courageous, mm-hmm. and right. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that like he seems very clear that like, no, I was doing the good thing. Mm-hmm. And there's little to no, and certainly not enough reflection on where you really,
yeah,
and how, yeah, do you know for sure,
right?
And like, I'm not even disputing that was the right thing to do, to kill the people that he killed. I obviously don't know a ton about,
right,
what he was doing at that moment, but I also would have preferred for him to grapple with that a little bit more and reconcile, like, how do I know that was the right thing to do, really, you know? And it's,
yeah, yeah,
I don't know, it would have been more interesting to me.
Yes, definitely. And also, like, I don't know, I just think that you can know the number and other people don't need to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he definitely doesn't, like, have to reveal that. And,
yeah,
like, there's a lot in here about his outlook on the military that I'm just like, okay.
Yeah, like, not like, into.
Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah, I think, like, if, as much as you might be going to therapy, it's going to take you many, many years to, like, make the progress that you would need for me to be like, okay with the way you talk about your military service.
Yeah.
So I get why he isn't successful in that at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, he talks about struggling from PTSD after he came back, and he talks about the lack of resources for veterans, all of which I found like very interesting and worthwhile, like writing about and sharing. He talks about like they were taken to a comedy show as like a decompression period between the time that they left their tour and the time that they were headed back. And
oh my God.
There were no mental health resources there. Like, you got a comedy show and then there was a priest available to talk to if anyone wanted to. And wow. He writes, like, of course no one did. And, yeah, you know, it's like just such a lack of understanding of how to help people who have just gone through something so traumatic like war. And I found that to be, like, really powerful and noteworthy.
Yeah, that is so fucked up. To be like, yeah, hey, you just killed some people. Why don't we go watch a comedy show?
Here's Dane Cook. It's like,
here's Dane Cook, a man who dates 12-year-olds. Isn't that hilarious?
I think that's not going to do it, sadly.
Oh my God. That's so bad. Yeah.
So, okay. There's also like, size again, a number of like things of just like, him not understanding racism.
Ugh.
He very life. Much looks at it from a like interpersonal interaction standpoint, okay, as opposed to thinking through like the structural implications of most things.
Okay.
He talks about two specific incidences where, and one, he dressed in a Nazi costume for a birthday party. The theme was natives and colonials.
Ew.
He talks about like, but he did that at like age, I don't know, 18 or something. And then he talks a little bit about like how he's ashamed of that.
Sure.
He starts like an education and understanding. He calls it not only a failure of education, not just school education, but self-education.
Mm-hmm.
He visited Auschwitz and goes through the process of like learning more about the atrocities that happened there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's clearly like him wanting to, mm-hmm, he's expressing a desire to grow, mm-hmm, and to change and to learn more, which I think is admirable. I don't know how much he really understands it, again, as like a structural prejudice mm-hmm. rather than like an individual one.
Mm-hmm.
He talks later about how he used a slur to describe a Pakistan or a person from Pakistan who was in his like platoon. And he didn't know that it was a slur, but it was recorded. And then it went to the press. And then people said he was racist. And then he, Yikes. You know, goes through this whole thing of, like, I was embarrassed.
Okay, whatever. But did you think it was a nice thing to call someone? Like, what are you talking about?
And then he said, yeah, so he says, they said, like, you can't go on the BBC and tell people you're not racist. That's not a good media strategy. And mm-hmm. he said, to hell with strategy. I don't care about strategy. I cared about people not thinking I was a racist. I cared about not being a racist. Above all, I cared about Ahmed, who was the guy that he had called a slur. I connected with him directly, apologized. He said he knew I wasn't a racist. No big deal. But it was, and his forgiveness, his easy grace, only made me feel worse. But there's no, like, recognition here that, like, yeah, Ahmed, like, said you weren't a racist or he doesn't believe you were being racist when you said that. And that's great, and I'm glad that you had that interpersonal conversation. But there's kind of not the second layer of, like, why is it not okay for me to say this to this person aside from just, like, hurt feelings? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And why did I not know that I shouldn't say that?
Yeah, yeah. And, like, why has no one taught me that? And it's probably because I've only been hanging out with a lot of white people, and mm-hmm. they themselves have not been taught anti-racist education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, like, a lot of layers that I'm not sure he's really, like, digging into.
Yeah, there's the whole piece of it where it's, like, we can believe that you weren't trying to be racist, but we can't really believe that you were trying not to be racist because you weren't.
Yeah.
And that's really what needs to happen. And it seems like there needs to be an acknowledgement of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I think that's, like, present throughout. There's obviously, mm-hmm. like, a clear lack of awareness of, like, his country being racist. Like, when all of these racist headlines come out about him marrying into gangster royalty because he's marrying Meghan Markle,
he writes, gross.
Like, my face froze, my blood stopped, I was angry but more ashamed. My mother country doing this to her, to us, really? And it's like, bro, you're from Britain. They did this to the whole world. That's what colonialism is.
Everyone, like, in India is like, what are you talking about? Is this the first time you're hearing of this?
Literally. And it's just like, that ignorance was irritating to me.
Yeah.
Because he does it, like, multiple times throughout the book. And it's like, I'm sorry, at some point, like, you should be retaining mm-hmm. that, like, this is not the exception, this is the rule.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Like, what, you know?
Yeah.
So
I saw an interview that he and Meghan did with Oprah where there's like a clip of it where Meghan is kind of looking at him and he's looking at Oprah being like, yeah, they were racist to her. And she's just like, uh-huh. And it's like, you dummy, could you stop acting so surprised?
Like, yeah. Like, it's like, okay, I feel like one of the first steps is, like, understanding that racism exists even when you don't experience it, white people. Yeah. And, like, there's just a lack of that, like, acknowledgement, which I feel like is, like, important. You have to have that to move forward in your, like, anti-racist journey. Yeah. So
I think it reminds me of how I felt when people acted really surprised about Roe v. Wade being overturned, where shocked and devastated and all of that is also how I felt, but this has been the plan for so many goddamn years, and they have they had the numbers to do it. So the fact that people felt surprised just made me so angry, because it was like, if you had maybe been paying more attention and not be so surprised right now, maybe we wouldn't fucking be here.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe if you had cared before the surprising event, it would have impacted the surprising event happening.
Right,
I don't know.
Right.
There's also a bit, in addition to the ignorance about racism,
mm-hmm.
about his just lack of general awareness of his privilege. Like
50-bedroom castle.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like, okay, so they're being hounded by the press from like 2018 until 2020. There are various times when they try to escape the press. And like at one time, he had a friend knew someone who knew someone who they could borrow a house on Vancouver Island free of charge.
Wow.
They escaped to Elton John's house in the south of France for a little bit. And then they escaped to like this house in Los Angeles, which was owned by Tyler Perry. And like throughout all of these, he's very like grateful to the people who lent him the house, but not necessarily like aware that when other people have problems, they don't just get like a free stay at a mansion, which was very weird to me. I'm like, not everyone can stay for free at Elton John's house in the south of France. Like, you do get that, right? Do you get that?
Yeah, I don't know. People can't even pay to stay there, actually.
People don't even get to know the address of that place, probably.
Yeah.
And then he also talks about after he was cut off financially from the royal family because they had sat down, that they like had to scramble and find a place, and they found a place, but it was priced at a steep discount just up the coast outside Santa Barbara.
Okay.
I'm like, bro, living in Santa Barbara. Do not give me a sob story about how you couldn't afford this house or whatever.
We have nosebleed seats in Malibu. Yeah, like, literally. Shut up. I hate you.
And I was like, okay, all right. I think we're done with this.
We really are done with this.
Okay. So this brings me to the final section, which was by far the most, like, I was actually infuriated after I read this. The rest of the stuff was like, whatever, eye-rolly, irritating, whatever.
Yes.
But this is just kind of outrageous to me. So he's talking about how they're leaving the royal family, they're renouncing their titles, or not, they never actually did that, so I don't know. But anyway, they're leaving the royal family, they've made this decision, the family is upset, whatever. And they have this, like, summit where they talk with each of the people in the royal family who are like, this would impact. And the royal family comes up with like five options.
Okay.
One being that you stay in the royal family and everything stays the same and status quo. And five being that like you get cut off from the royal family and you renounce your titles and you go be a normal person. Normal in quotation marks. And
then like the in between, it's like stages, like in between.
Yeah, like gradation. Yeah.
Okay, got it.
And it's like he really wanted to live his life fully alone, but also on someone else's dime. Like, it's very clear that he like didn't want to give up the money. He didn't want to give up the travel. He still wanted to like be a representation of the monarchy, but he also like wanted to have more privacy and wanted to not feel the pressures of it. At which point I'm like, okay, you cannot have your cake and eat it too.
No.
You have to make a choice. You don't get to have all the things. If you want to be a real person, that does mean you have to make your own money.
Yes. Also, that's not even something that the royal family has control over. They can't be like, yes, you can remain a representative and have this money, and also the press will leave you alone. Like, that's right. Not something they can do for you.
Right.
So.
Right. Also, like, let's be real. No matter how much you are or are not involved, I think the press will never fully leave you alone at this point. Like,
yeah. Which is, like, maybe the calculation for him was, like, well, then I want to at least have some of the, like, money and capital still if I'm going to be hounded by the press. But it's like, yeah, but that's... But what, you don't want to have any of the, like, responsibility and burden of the crown? Like, come on.
Yeah, yeah. So then he goes on to say, he's having this little like section where he's talking about like the monarchy and like how people in Britain were upset that the family paid for his wedding. A huge portion of the remaining cost was for security, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they like up and left the family. And so people are like, well, we paid for this massive wedding and then you guys left. And why did we pay for that? And so he's kind of talking about like the public opinion about that. So this is a quote. Maybe money sits at the heart of every controversy about monarchy. Britain has long had trouble making up its mind. Many support the crown, but many also feel anxious about the cost. That anxiety is increased by the fact that the cost is unknowable. Depends on who's crunching the numbers. Does the crown cost taxpayers? Yes. Does it also pay a fortune into government coffers? Also yes. Does the crown generate tourism income that benefits all? Of course. Does it also rest upon lands obtained and secured when the system was unjust and wealth was generated by exploited workers and thuggery, annexation, and enslaved people? Can anyone deny that? According to the last study I saw, the monarchy costs the average taxpayer the price of a pint each year, in light of its many good works that seem a pretty sound investment. But no one wants to hear a prince argue for the existence of a monarchy any more than they would want to hear a prince argue against it. I leave cost-benefit analyses to others. My emotions are complicated on this subject, naturally. My bottom line position isn't. I'll forever support my queen, my commander-in-chief, my granny, even after she's gone. My problem has never been with the monarchy nor the concept of monarchy. It's been with the press and the sick relationship that's evolved between it and the palace. I love my mother country, and I love my family, and I always will. I just wish at the second darkest moment of my life, they'd been there for me. And I believe they'll look back one day and wish they had too. So first of all, there's a lot to unpack there, but that these specific lines, where one, he says, no one wants to hear a prince argue for the existence or argue against the existence of the monarchy. I'm like, yes, we do. I would explicitly love it if you went into what does that really mean? I should grapple with this institution that I'm a part of that has caused so much pain. Also, like, don't feed me the line about they're doing so many good works. Your good works wouldn't be necessary if you wouldn't fucked the world over. So don't give me that. Like,
yeah. It's weird to go through all of that and then be like, but obviously I support the monarchy 100%.
Yes! It's like, I'm sorry. So we're at page 300 and some. Okay. Like 386 of 415. Mm-hmm. And at this point, he has spent the vast majority of it complaining about all of these struggles, how hard it is, the challenges of being in the monarchy. And then at the end, he's like, should the monarchy exist? That's for others to decide.
But also he's like, yes, it should.
Yeah. And it's like, wait, how can you even say that at the end of this?
Yeah. It renders most of what you have said leading up to that meaningless.
Yeah, completely meaningless. Because it's like, I can't help you if you're not willing to come out and say, I don't think that this institution should exist because it's harming people, both in small interactions and in big.
Yeah. And the cost analysis benefit that you said you weren't going to do but did is, yes, like, it doesn't come out with it being worth it.
No. And it also is, like, very clear that he's being a little bit cagey about, mm-hmm, does it do good? Because it's like, well, you're kind of saying yes, but you don't cite specific examples necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's very vague. And you're like, well, does it cost money? Well, it depends on who's counting. And it's like, well, I'm sorry. Can we back up? Who is counting? Like, what are you talking about?
And
like,
also, weren't you the one who was so boo-hoo because you were going to lose all that money? Like, don't act like money isn't an issue. Like,
right. Ugh.
Yeah. Not so great. Anyway. No nuance. Very, like, childish handling of the whole conversation.
Very bad. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Bad. Okay. So
bad show, boy.
That's pretty much it. I do have one last snort break that I want to share. So just as, like, a quick thing, he, for some unknown reason, decides to shorten words throughout the book that he promptly never uses again. So an example is that at one point he shortens the word interpreter to just terp, but then he never uses the nickname ever again. So it's like, you didn't need to do that. Oh, you don't need to do that. What are we doing?
What a doofus. He's like, yeah, let's get all that good British slang in there. Like my todger. Oh, how dare you, sir. I would have lived happily never hearing that.
Very, very happily. Ecstatic, actually. So, okay, that We have made it through Spare. I have a couple of pop culture pairings. If you are interested in themes of colonialization and imperialism, I read a good book last year. It's a nonfiction book called Inventing Latinos by Laura E. Gomez. Nice. And it's more about like the United States influence on Latin America. And I thought that was really interesting. There's also a good fiction book that I'm reading right now called The Seven Moons of Molly Almeida by Shehan Karina Tilaka. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I tried to look it up on YouTube. It was unclear. It is by a Sri Lankan man who actually, he won the Booker Prize for this book, I think, in it might have been 2022. I can't remember.
Okay.
But it's like about a man who has died and he is in between worlds and he is trying to figure out who killed him and what happened to him as he navigates this sort of afterlife, which is really interesting.
Wow. Okay.
And then feel like I have to say something about the Irish who were the ones really celebrating the Queen's death on Twitter. So I would recommend watching The Banshees of Inisherin, which is just
so good.
Such a good movie.
So
I
good.
Loved it so much.
Yes.
I think it was it nominated for Best Picture?
I don't know.
I think it was nominated for something at the Oscars.
Yeah.
But I loved it.
We saw that. It was the soundtrack, like everything.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Jenny.
Yeah, I will never be over that. That was unnecessary and heartbreaking, but that was so good. Yes.
Such a good movie.
Yeah.
So those are my recommendations. If you're interested in like the royal family, I think there are, I don't know, perhaps 3 billion books
that you could read about. I feel like them. You could find something.
So there's nothing really that I have to recommend. I did like the You're Wrong About podcast when they did about Princess Diana. I think they did like a 5-part series.
Oh, I don't think I ever listened to that one.
I thought it was good. Yeah. And, you know, again, they worked to sort of make it more humanizing, which was interesting.
Yeah. So. I was in Paris in September, as you know, and I walked past the tunnel where Diana died. And they still put flowers out. Like people, tourists are still putting flowers out. And it makes me so sad. And but I think it's also, I don't know, maybe I'm sure that like William and Harry don't feel this way, but it's nice to know that so many people loved her and remember her and are still grieving her too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think he does kind of go into that. Like, he goes into, like, how special it is to have someone is a part of your family that was so beloved.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I think, yeah, I'm sure that must be very special to see, like, how many other people saw the good things in her that you did.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, like, recognize how tragic her death and so hard like parts of her life were.
Mm-hmm.
yeah Well, that was so good. What a fucking nightmare.
I am so glad that I'm done reading this book.
Thank you for falling on your sword.
It's like literally a sword that I pulled out, so I can't even complain. Like, I was like, should I? And you were like, I don't care. And I was like, I'm doing it. And you're like, okay.
I must. I'll take one for the team.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad I will be the hero here. And you're like, no one cares. I don't know what you're doing.
Oh, that was great. We have no idea what we're doing next. It's going to be a surprise for everyone, including us. But join us next time. For whatever that is.
We put out a movie instead of a podcast.
We just have our dogs record the next episode.
We start a band.